The next case for argument is case number 82991. Our counsel present for that case. I know that a number of counsel are present or may be joining in connection with our Rule 33 conference. As a matter of courtesy to you all, this argument is scheduled for a half an hour. If you wish to stay and watch it, that's fine. If you prefer to go back out in the lobby, that's also fine, but I want you to be aware that we are going to take about a 5-minute break after this argument before we hear your comments on the Rule 33 question in the Sullivan matter. All right, this is case 82991 in the matter of the trust agreement with 23 Partners Trust 1. Michael, is it correctly pronounced Netter versus Douglas DeLuca versus Joanne S. Briggs et al. Is that correct? Pronounced correctly? Okay. All right. Let's proceed with appellant's argument.
Good afternoon, Justice Hardesty and the court. And may it please the court, it is a privilege to be here. My name is Alex Velto. I'm with Hutchison and Steffen Law Firm, and I'm here on behalf of appellants and cross-respondents, Michael Netter and Douglas DeLuca, who serve as trustees for 23 Partners, and I request to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you. The Nevada legislature chose to set Nevada apart from other jurisdictions by creating a state favorable to forming and maintaining trusts that adhere to the trust score's intent. For instance, Nevada was one of the first states to authorize spendthrift trusts, and since that time, at least two legislatures have affirmed the state's commitment to a model for estate planning that is distinct from other states' common law and statutory schemes. Now, the trust before you provides absolute and unbridled discretion to the trustee to provide any benefit the trustee decides to the beneficiaries. And the issue before you is the extent to which NRS 163 and NRS 165 require a trustee to provide a non-vested contingent beneficiary either an annual accounting or the terms of the trust when that very trust provides absolute discretion to the trustee. In answering this question, the court does not need to look beyond statutes, the legislature's prescribed policies, or the four corners of the trust. Now here, the district court reached the correct legal conclusion that no accounting or disclosure is required under Nevada law. However, it issued an order that directly contradicts that legal conclusion. This court should affirm the district court's legal conclusions, but reverse its ultimate order that the trustees provide effectively an accounting and the trust without giving any direction as to what relevant portions are. First, as to the error regarding the accounting for discretionary interest, the district court erred when it ordered the trustees to provide annual financial information, including tax returns and a complete beginning and ending inventory of the trust assets. The district court properly reached the conclusion that the beneficiary interest in the trust had not vested. So the children are not entitled to an accounting of the trust assets or a copy of the trust agreement. Now, despite this legal conclusion, the district court effectively required an accounting, and it did so without a legal basis.
Mr. Velto, under your, how could this trust vest?
Your Honor, I guess the trust.
I mean, it's provided for in 5.2 with respect to the beneficiaries. So how could this vest, if that's what the grantor seems to have put in there?
Your Honor, I guess the trust itself cannot vest for the beneficiaries so long as there's absolute discretion. The trust itself indicates that the beneficiaries have access to some entitlement, but only at the discretion of the trustee. And because there's no absolute entitlement, it is always contingent, and there is an unvested interest. Now, to understand the
So no beneficiary could ever be vested under the language of that trust?
Under the terms of the trust as written, they cannot be vested because they are purely discretionary interests. And more importantly, under Nevada law, specifically NRS 165-1207, it provides that a trustee is not required to provide accounting to an interest when that interest is only discretionary. Now, discretionary interest is defined in NRS 163.4187, which says that an interest is not vested. Rather, it is discretionary so long as the trustee has discretion as to what that interest could be. The clause, as has been alluded to, can be found at 2AA242, says that the trustee has absolute and unreviewable discretion. Because they have unreviewable discretion, there's no vested interest for the beneficiaries. And because there's no vested interest for the beneficiaries, there's no ability for them to claim access to an accounting or to the access to the trust itself. This goes to the trustor's intent. Nevada chose to adopt a system whereby that trustor's intent can be respected. And this is distinguishable from many of the cases.
Does your position, you think, respect the trustor's intent?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it does. Mm-hmm. And I think that the intent can specifically be found if you look to sections 5.2 of the trust. There are specific portions of the trust, let me rephrase that. There are specific instruments under the trust which are to be disclosed. Those largely have to do with changes after the fact. So if there's a revocation, if there's an amendment, that's what's to be disclosed under the trust, and that's what's the trustor's intent.
Does that seem odd, though, that there be that we'd interpret it such that you can get copies of changes to a trust you've never seen or been provided a copy of? I mean, what context does that leave?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would acknowledge to you that it is not necessarily intuitive, but I don't necessarily think we should be counter-guessing what the legislature has decided as the prescribed intent. And the legislature seems to have delegated to the trustee a lot of discretion. So this is the large distinction, though, between a lot of the cases that are cited by respondents and the cross appellants. Many of their issues raised rely on places where there is a common law that creates some sort of right for contingent beneficiaries or non-vested beneficiaries. But the Nevada legislature has expressly limited that right. Now, one argument raised by the opposition deals with NRS 165.180. This portion of statute identifies when a court is able to require an accounting of the trustee. However, it doesn't identify why the court is allowed to require an accounting. To understand why, the court has to look to NRS 165.147 and 163.419. Both of these deal with the accounting and the access to the trust themselves. These create a for-cause requirement. If there was any reason why the trustee was acting with malfeasance, or there was a cause for the trustee to show that there was fraud, dishonesty, something that would give rise to a claim to access the accounting, that would allow a court to force the trustee to disclose this information. I should note for the record that there's absolutely nothing indicating that there's been dishonesty, bad faith, or willful misconduct. There's also been no finding. And quite to the contrary, the record establishes that the trustee administered the trust quite liberally to the benefit of the beneficiaries. The trustee has been giving out $7,200 a month to the children's mother for their housing expenses, a significant amount of money to the credit card payments, as well as other expenses that were requested by the trustee's parents. Now, I think the court should really understand why it's purposeful to limit this information. There are a number of policy considerations that are consistent with Nevada's legislative scheme. It helps mitigate creditor claims. If a beneficiary has knowledge over what amount of money is in a trust, but more importantly, if a creditor has that knowledge, a creditor can position themselves to try to chip away at the money that is specifically preserved for the trustee at their discretion to give to the beneficiaries. The second important reason why Nevada's legislative scheme should be upheld is that it protects the fiduciary's role. A trustee is not always going to make equal distributions. This could have harmful effects on a beneficiary. It could also have harmful effects on family harmony. If there's open knowledge as to what amounts of money are given out and how the trustee is acting on their discretion, it could inhibit the ability for a family to maintain a harmonious relationship. There's also the risk that a parental guardian could try to game the system, understanding what money is being allocated to specific beneficiaries, and then attempt to take advantage of what money is available for the beneficiaries. All of these are reasons why Nevada's legislature has decided to create discretion and not protect the rights for discretionary interested beneficiaries. Now, turning to the issue of why, whether the trust should be disclosed, the trustees are not entitled to a copy of the trust agreement. And part of the fundamental error by the district court is that the district court ordered disclosure of relevant provisions. The district court had access to the document. The district court gave no direction as to what those relevant provisions are. Instead, it just directed the trustee to make this decision without giving them any indication as to what that needs to look like. The trust itself has a confidentiality clause. It reads, notwithstanding anything herein to the contrary, and to the extent permitted by law, trustees shall not provide notice of the existence of the trust to any beneficiary. Section 5.2 builds on that confidentiality by requiring certain disclosures, but expressly limiting those disclosures to amendments, revocations, things that we've just talked about.
But while you're talking about like 5.2, let me ask you a question. I mean, it seems kind of illogical that in 5.2, the grantor stated that beneficiaries would be entitled to financial information, but your position is that they're only entitled to that accounting if they're vested and they can never be vested under the trust. So I have to assume the grantor intentionally included language about their entitlement to financial information about the trust, but your position is they're not entitled to it at all. And nobody could be under your view because they're not, no beneficiary could be vested.
Well, Your Honor, the grantor intended for vested beneficiaries to have access to that information, and that's the precise language from that portion of Section 5.2. That language is a term of art, which is also reflected in statute. So we look to the statute to understand that definition. And a vested interest doesn't exist so long as the beneficiaries purely have discretionary interest. So while I understand your position, I think that there's a claim to be made that trustee has to give some information, which the record supports our trustee has been giving information to the beneficiaries and summarizing information. There's not a requirement under the trust because they're not a vested beneficiary. I don't think it'd be appropriate necessarily to look past the trust and look past the clear and concise language, especially when there's reciprocal language in statute that informs how we would understand that language inside in the trust.
Counsel, are any of the beneficiaries also remainder beneficiaries?
Your Honor, I think the remainder beneficiaries at this point are not known, given that the trust could go on and is intended to go on to future parties. So there is a priority in the trust that the focus of the benefit should be on those that are more, that are alive, those that on the children, but there's no limit on when that would end. So they could potentially be remainder beneficiaries if there were nobody to take the benefit in the future. However, the trust also indicates that the family trustee, Mr. DeLuca, could potentially become a remainder beneficiary as well.
So my concern is the completion of the sentence in 5.2. I think I understand your argument about how one defines the present vested interest in income and principal, but the sentence concludes with "and remainder beneficiary of such trust and their respective representatives." There doesn't seem to be a qualification on the definition of remainder beneficiary. I don't know that that was really briefed. I'm curious to know what you think about that. And I'm going to be asking your opponent the same question.
Your Honor, I would agree with you that that issue was not briefed by the parties. As far as being a remainder beneficiary, there is no guarantee that they are a remainder beneficiary because they're not presently entitled something.
I'm trying to determine, maybe it phrased a different way, Mr. Abelto, is are they prospective remainder beneficiaries? And I know I'm adding a word, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, remainder beneficiaries oftentimes are just that, they're prospective.
I guess, Your Honor, they could prospectively be remainder beneficiaries. My concern is that the language with that reading should have more information, especially because it seems like the trustor is trying to, if the trustor intended for the beneficiaries or the discretionary beneficiaries to be entitled access, the trustor would have said that.
Yeah.
And I think that given that the language doesn't include that language or the additional word that you've identified, it's difficult
to
read.
Well, in the context of the spendthrift trust provision, statutory provisions, I don't have them in mind right now, and I was didn't have time to look at it before this argument. But how does the Spendthrift Trust, if you know, address remainder beneficiaries in Spendthrift Trusts? And if and I understand you may not,
Your Honor, I can't give you an answer to that at this point.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal as you request it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Justice Stiglitz, Hardesty, and Herndon. My name is Alex Levesque, the law firm Solomon, Dugan, Spear, and Stedman, and I have the privilege to represent the respondents across the balance in this matter. Today marks exactly 4 years and 2 months since Julie and Alex's father, John DeLuca, passed away from terminal cancer. And at that time, Julia was 15 and Alex was 12. In 2017, John formed the trust for the benefit, primary benefit of his two children. And based on information that John gave his wife, the mother of the children, before he died, this trust was funded somewhere between $18 and $24 million. Of course, we don't know for sure, because this trustee has refused to account to give these kids one shred of financial information, one balance sheet. Not because the trust prevents it or prohibits it, or Nevada law prevents it or prohibits it, but because he's choosing on his own accord to not provide that information. Why? Trustee says to honor the settlor's intent. Where in this trust does John direct the trustee to keep his kids in the dark and permit a veil of secrecy? It's not in there. In fact, the opposite is the case. Both the trust instrument and Nevada law affords Alex and Julia the right to accountings and a complete copy of the trust instrument. We therefore request that at a minimum, this court affirm the district court's order to the extent that it is requiring the trustees to provide certain financial information and portions of the trust. And because the beneficiaries are entitled to a full accounting under 165 and the terms of the trust itself, we further request that the court remand this matter to the district court and instruct the trustee to produce the same. There are two reasons for why Alex and Julia are entitled to an accounting and a complete copy of the trust, and one primary reason for why the district court did not abuse its discretion when it ordered production of certain information, even if Alex and Julia didn't otherwise have that right under 165 of the trust. All these reasons directly relate to the three ways a beneficiary can get an accounting under Nevada law. The first way is under the terms of the trust. The second way is under 165-1207 if you're a current beneficiary. And the third way is within the court's discretion under 165-180. And that, I'll explain in a little bit, is just a codification of the common law. With respect to the first, Section 5.2A expressly provides that certain beneficiaries are entitled to an accounting. The question before this court is who? We've answered that question. The trustee has not. Two, Alex and Julia have an independent right to an account under 165 because they have more, quote, interests in this trust other than just a discretionary distribution interest. Answering that question would require a review of 165-1207 and a couple other statutes. Third, the district court did not commit error because it has authority under 165-180 to order a trustee to account, or conversely, to direct a trustee not to account, even if he otherwise is required to under 165. That discretion goes both ways. Finally, the remaining issue to be addressed is whether providing portions of the trust under the current district court order is good enough. We submit that it's not when you consider the trust as a whole and under 165-137, which requires production of the trust if this court finds that accounting is warranted. I don't disagree with counsel that we don't have to go much further than the trust instrument or the plain meaning of the statutes. In fact, I don't think we have to go much further than the trust itself. In fact, that's what this court has been instructs the district court to do in Connell 2 from 2018, which I believe, Justice Hardesty, you were on bonk as well as Justice Stiglitz in that decision. This court stated that the court construes trust in a manner affecting the apparent intent of the settlor. By considering the trust as a whole and favoring the most fair and reasonable interpretation of the trust language. The section at issue, section 5.2, clearly says that some type of beneficiary is entitled to an accounting, a presently vested income principal and remainder beneficiary. What does that mean? There's no dispute that they're the present beneficiary, and there's no dispute that they're a beneficiary for income and principal should the trustee exercise its discretion to make the distribution. The question that I guess is the issue is, what does vested mean? Well, Your Honors, there are only two classes of beneficiaries in this trust, period. There can't be any more. They're the primary beneficiaries, who are Alex and Julia, and then the other class, if you call it that, are their descendants. The primary beneficiaries have more rights than the descendants, the main one being that they've got a power of appointment they can exercise, a testamentary limited power of appointment, where they could actually divest this trust of the assets upon their death and distribute it to their issue. And I submit that under Connell 2, if you look at what the word vested means within the term, within the trust instrument itself, all that really means is just those beneficiaries who have a present right to receive distribution of income or principal if such distribution is made by the trustee. There is no other rational explanation. And if the court is required to go outside the trust, which I submit it's not, we don't have to ascertain exactly what vested means. Because under this trust, it must mean either my clients or their descendants. Because under Connell 1, we strive to avoid an interpretation that would avoid a superfluous provision in the trust. And if the court were to adopt the trustee's position, Section 5.2, with respect to the beneficiary issue, would be superfluous. Because under their interpretation, no one would ever be vested. Now, they go outside, if we have to go outside.
Wasn't the reason that the legislature enacted spendthrift trust statutes was to try to protect the beneficiaries from credit their creditors? And essential to that process was to create some level of uncertainty. The word vested does have a relevance here to their access to the trust income.
Yes, Your Honor.
That seems to be the public policy of this state in enacting spendthrift trust provisions.
So there is certainly a strong policy of spendthrift law in Nevada. I mean, that was set forth in 2017 by this court. Justice Hersey, you were in the Black v. Nelson case. But we're talking about apples and oranges. We really are, because when you're talking about a right to an accounting, that is part of the internal administration and affairs of a trust. That is between a beneficiary and a trustee. And the most fundamental duty that a trustee owes a beneficiary is the duty to account. Accounting is irrelevant with respect to spendthrift law, because under spendthrift law, under 166, that is where you have an outside creditor coming in seeking to attack the validity of a trust. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the beneficiary is entitled to accounting information bears no relevance, I don't think, on whether a creditor can or cannot attach on assets of the trust.
The relevancy of the inquiry would be whether the beneficiary has a fixed and certain distribution. As opposed to access to accounting, is your argument.
Yes, and just because a beneficiary has a right to an accounting does not mean a creditor does.
Yeah.
And then if we really want to talk about the reasoning and rationale behind 1207, 165, 1207, that came as a result of a major overhaul of 165 in 2015, where there was an effort to try to be more in conformance with the East Coast. And the concern wasn't really about spendthrift or creditors. It had to do with banks, because banks and professional trust companies were getting sick and tired of having a beneficiary of a pot trust where they have no interest other than a discretionary interest trying to demand an accounting. It was incredibly cumbersome. But in this instance, Your Honor, it's different because there are only discretionary beneficiaries in this case. So who would hold the trustee accountable? That's number one. Number two, this kind of ties into our analysis under 165-180, and when I talked about when 165 was amended in 2015, what was intentionally left untouched was 165-180. And that statute, Your Honor, has been on the books since 1941. It was part of Nevada's adoption of the Uniform Trustee Accounting Act of 1936. That statute has not changed substantively. The only amendment, I think, was in 1999, where it made technical revisions to it, but the whole point of that statute is a codification of the common law, which is recognized also in Boberts, that we cited that notwithstanding whether a beneficiary has a right to an accounting under 165, a court sitting in equity always has the ability.
So let me ask this question. Under finding number six, the judge said the beneficiaries are not entitled to an annual accounting under the terms of the trust. That finding would be contrary to your interpretation of the provisions or the sentence in section 5.2 that we're talking about, wouldn't
it? Yes, Your Honor.
And so what's the basis of the judge's finding in number six? Isn't that exactly what one of the other provisions in the trust says?
I don't know how the court could have reached an interpretation that the beneficiaries are entitled to an accounting under the terms of the trust when there's only one type of beneficiary. So there's no way, no operation of law under the terms of the trust where my clients would somehow become vested. And we have to, like I said, avoid an interpretation
Could you circle back to my question?
Yes.
Is there a provision in the trust that prohibits or bars the beneficiary's entitlement to an annual accounting?
Absolutely not. No. There is no express provision that
I'm just trying to figure out where the judge got this finding. Because it makes the other provisions in her order inconsistent, where the parties would not be entitled not only to an accounting, but number seven says they're not entitled to audit the books and records every year under the terms of the trust. They're entitled to review, beneficiaries, however, are entitled to review the trust books and records if for instance, an item in the tax returns warrants further inquiry. These findings seem internally inconsistent to me.
I agree with Your Honor, and that's why when I started at the beginning of my argument that even though we don't disagree that under the court's plenary power under 165, 180, that they can, a court can otherwise order that information, mm-hmm. the court did error because under the express terms of the trust, beneficiaries are entitled to an accounting, and therefore we wouldn't have to have a split the baby approach. They'd be entitled to everything that not only is provided for under section 5.2, but also 165, 135.
Are there any other provisions that you point to in the trust other than 5.2 that entitle your clients to an annual accounting or the other accountings that the judge says you're not entitled to?
So Your Honor brought up the issue of remainder beneficiary, and that's an interesting issue because...
Now that's not been briefed to the district court or up here, right?
It hasn't, but there's been case law actually cited by the appellant that they tried making that point. But it isn't a trust, and I think that's fair game for the court and counsel. They are remainder beneficiaries. If you look at section 9.5 of the trust can terminate for what's called unusual circumstances, and it enumerates certain things like changes in law or court orders that could adversely affect the trust or tax policy. And in the event that the trustee or court terminates the trust, the beneficiaries are the beneficiaries. They are entitled to a mandatory distribution of trust corpus. To the extent that they are remainder beneficiaries, yes. Now, is it likely that one of those events are going to occur? Probably not. But they are remainder beneficiaries should the trust terminate during their lifetime. And they cited the case of, I think it was Henderson. In Henderson, the facts were that the settlor, the trust provided that the trust terminated 10 years after the death of the settlor. And in that case, this court determined that the beneficiaries were vested beneficiaries because they were entitled to receive the corpus 10 years after the death of the mm-hmm. settlor. Similarly, in our trust, the trust does terminate, of course. Our rule against perpetuity is much longer than Georgia. Ours is 365 years, but at some point, once this trust terminates in 365 years, whoever the beneficiaries are do receive the remainder interest. Unlike sometimes in the trust where if a trust terminates at a certain point, you sometimes have a charity or something like that. That's not the case here. I have to just briefly talk about a couple things. I only have about a minute left here. This court used the term vested. It's used it before in the Amicon case, which I believe Justice Stiglitz, you were on the bond for that, as you were to Justice Hardesty. And Amicon was somewhat similar in that the court was reviewing a discretionary distribution interest. And as part of that opinion, the first page summarized the relevant portions of that trust. And on page one of that unpublished opinion, 2018, the court says, quote, among its provisions, the trust vested the beneficiary with a present interest, which provided that, quote, the trustee may pay or apply such parts of the income and principal of the trust to or for the benefit of the beneficiary during her lifetime for her support in the trustee's discretion. So this very court used the term vested when it was talking about a discretionary distribution interest. And that's why I don't think we have to go much further than that. By the way, other than that Henderson case, the trustee has cited no authority to support his position on what vested means. And I think because of that, it's not helpful. Number one, because that case is 42 years ago in Georgia. Number two, the quote that they said was in the case actually wasn't. They said that there was a quote that vested meant that portion of the trust estate that was subject to a creditor claim. Nowhere in that opinion does it say that. I just finished this thought. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Because in that case, the issue was not looking at the discretionary distribution interest for income. It was only talking about a distribution of the remainder. And Nevada is extremely different than Georgia law, where to answer your Honor's question posed earlier, under 166, remainder interests are still subject to spendthrift protection. Neither a court nor a creditor compel a trustee to make a distribution of income or principal if it's a valid spendthrift trust in Nevada law. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll add a minute to your time, Mr. Velto.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are three things I want to cover based on the argument for opposing counsel. The first is the last point, which goes to the relevance of creditor claims. A creditor can certainly request the accounting, or it can use subpoena power to request the accounting if the beneficiary, or in this case, the discretionary beneficiary, has access to that information. If there's a pattern of distribution, then the creditor may be able to adequately predict that pattern of distribution and attempt to take money that otherwise should be intended for discretionary beneficiary. Now, I think that is not always the case, but it could be the case, and not every court is going to see these spendthrift trusts as rigidly as what they should, which is precisely why there needs to be some sort of discretion, and there's no requirement to accounting. The second point is that goes to the remainder beneficiary question posited by yourself, Justice Hardesty. The beneficiaries are not remainder beneficiaries. They are contingent remainder beneficiaries because their remainder status is contingent on some sort of unique action. This is identified in the trust as a set of circumstances that could make them remainder beneficiaries, but it is contingent on that action for them to become remainder beneficiaries. Otherwise, remainder beneficiaries are those that are alive or exist at the end of the statutory period until that statutory period concludes. The third point I want to address is the relevance of NRS 165.180. This seems to imply that district courts have discretion in order to require an accounting. However, it's not unbridled discretion, and it's important to look to the other statutes for context. The other portions of both 163 and 165 require there to be good cause and identify what an accounting is. There's no right for a contingent beneficiary or a non-vested beneficiary or a discretionary beneficiary to have access to an accounting or to have access to the terms of the trust, and the court can require that upon good cause. So I think it's important when you're looking at 165.180 to look at it in the context of the other statutes, which do create good cause requirements. Looking at the trust itself, there is one type of beneficiary presently alive. They are discretionary beneficiaries. The trust doesn't require an accounting. The trust doesn't require a disclosure of the terms. The district court was correct in its conclusions that the trust doesn't require that. And as such, this court should affirm the district court in part, but reverse and remand to ensure that the required disclosures are not made, because there's no reason why good cause warrants it. There's no findings, there's no evidence, and there's no claims of bad faith on the part of the trustees. And for that reason, I request that the district court, or that this court, rule as was stated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both, counsel, for your excellent briefing and arguments here today. As I mentioned earlier, the court will take about a 5-minute recess. We will return at 3:00 and invite counsel in the Sullivan versus Lincoln County Water District matter to make their come forward and be ready to make their appearances for the Rule 33 conference.